presentation on our workshop today sort of brings us back to the issue at hand, which is how to protect our natural areas, or in this case perhaps restore our natural areas after they've been invaded by invasive species. And so I'm very pleased to introduce Adrian Smith, a PhD candidate in the University of Florida, who's going to tell us about this aspect. Adrian?
Well, before I begin, I have to thank you, Dr. Knox, for inviting me to speak here during this session and for the opportunity to get information about what our lab does on invasive plant management. I'll be presenting work done by myself and my co-authors listed here, as well as undergraduate research on this topic. So today I will be talking about basically asking the question, is invasive species control the goal or just the first step in restoration of the native plant community? And you'll see our work has answered some questions relating to this topic, but it's also raised many others. So there are two parts of this presentation. With the first, I hope to contribute to the session by discussing what we have learned from the scientific literature on invasive plant control, and then using what we learned in part one and applying it to Ruellia simplex invasive floodplain forest here in Florida as a case study. And this photo here shows a Ruellia invasion in Sanford, which is about an hour east from here. So as we have learned in this session and elsewhere, invasions lead to both detrimental ecosystem and economic impacts. And while the scale of the problem is well documented, there's very little information on restoration. And this could be a problem for land managers trying to restore these natural areas. Land managers typically have two objectives. The first is to reduce invasive species abundance, and the second is to promote native species establishment. So Carrie and one of her colleagues began to ask, how can we best interpret the scientific literature to better address these objectives for land managers? Well, what did they do? Well, they conducted a literature review for a grant proposal and actually ended up as a publication. And it's ultimately offered some guidance on how our lab conducts experiments on invasive plant control. Their question was, are there some generalizations we can make about the best way to move from an invader-dominated system to a restored one? Their goal was to understand what we have learned from invasive plant research. And to look at this research in a more objective way, they conducted a systematic review and meta-analysis of the published peer-reviewed literature. And this here is a screenshot of that paper that was published in 2011. Well, they began by searching multiple databases and identified 10,000 papers on invasive plant control. And with each of those papers, they were looking for two different criteria. One, they wanted to know if those papers quantified the response of plants and if they had a before and after treatment or had a comparison with untreated experimental design. So based upon those two criteria, they were able to select 350 papers for their analysis. And they analyzed the difference between the means of treated and untreated units. Here are some results from that study. They found that the most common control practices are burning, cutting and removal, and herbicide application. And of those common control practices, 58% of those papers looked at invader response only, 30% looked at invader and native response, and 12% looked at native response only. So this means that over half of the studies are assessing restoration success without even measuring native plant response. But we can still learn from this data set. So here are the mean response ratios from the meta-analysis for both percent cover and biomass. In the top figure, we have percent cover, and the bottom is biomass. So to reorient all of you, on the y-axis, we have the three control treatments, burn, cut, and removal, and herbicide. And along the x-axis, we have the mean response ratio. The black circles are native response, the white circles are invasive response. And circles to the right of the red dotted line indicate a gain as a result of each treatment. and circles found to the left of the red dotted line indicate a reduction as a result of each treatment. So what they found was that there were significant drops in the invader, especially when it was applied with herbicide, as you can see here for both percent cover and biomass. However, there were very little gains in native species across all treatments. And even when there were larger decreases in the invader, it did not translate to larger increases in the native. And the authors also noted that there are wide ranges in response to each treatment. So unfortunately, there was no clear treatment winner here, but it looks like herbicide shows the most potential in at least reducing the invader. And this figure here is for plant density. So it looks very similar to what we just saw. However, we were able to add native revegetation along the y-axis. And the conclusions were the same before, but we were able to add another conclusion. The authors found that even when native revegetation was applied, there was very little increase in native response. But the authors also noted that only 33% of the papers in that meta-analysis even consider native revegetation. And so they conclude that this is a critical area of research. So here are the major conclusions from that paper. They found that while they tried to find some general guidelines for managers, it did not reveal a silver bullet in managing invasive plants. And even when the control techniques reduced the invader, it did not promote the native plant community. And so invasive species control alone may not be sufficient to achieve restoration. However, these findings did help produce two guidelines for further research. One, herbicide modes could consistently reduce invasives. And two, that revegetation methods are seriously under-researched. So using what we gained in part one, we're going to apply it to a case study here. Using Ruellia simplex invaded floodplain forest here in Florida. Ruellia simplex is also known as Mexican petunia. It is a commonly planted ornamental plant in the southeastern United States, as you can see here by this EDIS map. It is currently listed as a Florida Exotic Pest Plant Council Category 1 invasive species for displacing native plant communities. The UF IFAS assessment does not recommend its use in Florida. And in comparison with the native Ruellia, the invasive shows faster and more complete germination and has a higher nutrient use efficiency, which may give it a competitive advantage over the native. Now, as I had just mentioned, it is a commonly planted ornamental plant, and the economic output for Florida nurseries alone is $12 billion. It is ranked third in herbaceous perennial sales in Florida alone. And we have three of our collaborators with the University of Florida, and I know they're making fun of this photo, but collaborators at the University of Florida are trying to shift the production of the invasive Ruellia to the use of native or non-invasive cultivars to help reduce the amount of propagule sources in the landscape. However, propagule sources are still found in established landscapes. And so this really elevates the importance of our work in trying to manage the species. And we consider these guys as our Ruellia team. These are the main Ruellia collaborators at the University of Florida. So here is some background information prior to our work on this species. Karen Hupp, a master's student at the University of Florida, looked at the specific zonation for Ruellia distribution. She found that germination was highest in this intermediate soil moisture and that young seedling survival decreased by competition. She also defined a hydrologic zone for management efforts, which in this photo here she designates as the Ruellia zone. Randall Stocker also found that two applications with glyphosate was enough to reduce Ruellia cover to less than 1%. So building upon what others have done before us, our first set of experiments looking at Ruellia control were herbicide trials. And those trials were conducted at Paynes Prairie Preserve State Park in Gainesville, Florida. And it was looking at the season of application, either fall or spring, or the number of applications ranging from 0 to 3. 0 meaning that those areas did not receive any herbicide. And the herbicide that we used was glyphosate, since that was found by Randall Stocker to be the most effective. So on this figure down here, we have Ruellia simplex percent cover along the y-axis, and we have the number of herbicide applications ranging from 0 to 3, and then also split up between the fall and spring applications. We also found that glyphosate did similarly reduce Ruellia. However, each additional application does not provide additional control, and that the spring or fall timing did not differ. So we conclude that a single application of glyphosate applied in either the fall or spring is enough to control Ruellia. However, even though we were able to gain control of Ruellia, Ruellia reduction did not lead to a gain in native species richness. So this figure looks similar to what we just saw before, except on the y-axis we had species richness, which ranges from 0 to 12. The black bars are total species richness, and the gray bars are native species richness. And again, even when Ruellia is controlled with a single application of glyphosate, or 2 or 3, we did not have an increase in native species richness. So the next step was to look at the mechanisms by which the Ruellia invasion is facilitated. And so to look at that, we began to look at the soils. And areas receiving stormwater runoff may be susceptible to nutrient enrichment. And as Sandy Wilson previously noted in a previous paper, she suggested that Ruellia may have a higher nutrient use efficiency, which may give it a competitive advantage over the other species in those degraded conditions. And a common trend is to see patchy invasions, either dense monocultures in narrow strips or huge patches that abruptly end, as you can see in this photo. So a greater understanding of the soil characteristics is needed to target these invasions. So an undergraduate student at the University of Florida did some preliminary testing on the soils, and she found that there was a higher pH and nitrogen at sites with Ruellia. So she then asked the question, well, what's the likely cause of this relationship? It could be from one of two things. One, either the presence of Ruellia is due to nutrient enrichment from runoff, or that Ruellia acts as an ecosystem engineer and actually causes the nutrient enrichment. So to look at that relationship further, she conducted two different experiments. Her first experiment was a field experiment looking at soils from both invaded and uninvaded soil at two locations in Gainesville. She found that there was higher pH in Ruellia-invaded areas. However, she found opposing trends in organic matter, meaning that there was high organic matter in one area dominated by Ruellia, but then there was also low organic matter in another area dominated by Ruellia. So there may be some site-level constraints to each invasion. She then conducted a greenhouse experiment looking at Ruellia and natural recolonization from the seed bank. However, she found few differences. But we only ran her study for 6 months because she unfortunately had to graduate. So we couldn't run it for longer because this was for her honors thesis. But we're hoping that maybe if we do it again, we'd run it for longer and we may see more differences there. So she concluded that it's unlikely that Ruellia modifies the soil and that stormwater runoff may actually facilitate the invasion. So prior to any restoration actions, we have to address stormwater runoff before we can proceed with the plans. And these photos here, this is our current master's student helping our undergraduate here collect soil, and then these are her trays in the greenhouse. So while we're still looking and investigating the soils, we're also considering using active revegetation to restore the native plant community. So for this section here, I will briefly present a chapter from my dissertation. But for more information, please check out my poster during the poster session tomorrow. As Karen Hupp acknowledged in her thesis, revegetating with native species while matched to the current site conditions may be enough to restore the native plant community while also limiting reinvasion of Ruellia. So to test this, we examined initial competition from seed between Ruellia and four native floodplain species during revegetation in the greenhouse. And my four native species that I used were Antipogon glomeratus, Juncus effusus, Panicum longifolium, and Solidago fistulosa. So my greenhouse experiment tested hydrology at two different levels, saturated versus unsaturated soil conditions, native seeding density, low and high, and three different native seeding compositions, which were Ruellia planted with Juncus, Ruellia planted with Solidago, and Ruellia planted with a broad mix of natives. And the broad mix consisted of all four native species that I was looking at. And I found that Ruellia preferred the saturated soil conditions, and that native species did suppress Ruellia survival. However, I had low germination of the natives overall, but of the natives that did germinate, they had a similar establishment timing as Ruellia. And this here shows Ruellia total biomass along the y-axis, and we have the different species compositions along the x-axis. And as you can see here, when Ruellia was planted with either Solidago or the broad mix, it reduced Ruellia total biomass as opposed to when it was just planted alone. So this is very encouraging and definitely a highlight of that study. My major conclusions were that native species can suppress Ruellia and that we need to target the invasions in the low elevations. And that confirms what Karen Hupp previously found back in 2009. And since I had overall low native germination, we need to use higher native seeding densities. So the next step is to test these approaches in the field, which I am currently doing right now. We installed that study back in November of 2013, and it is running for years, so it will not end until November 2014. But I look forward to sharing that information with you at a later date. So back to answering our original question. I think we can say in most cases, invasive species control is just the first step in restoring these invaded natural areas, and that many scenarios require active revegetation in order to restore the native plant community. And so this is why our lab focuses on researching effective methods, and it takes many people and even some margaritas with our members of our support team down here. But for Ruellia, we have established techniques for control, but we are currently working toward methods of active revegetation. And before I end, I have to thank many cooperators, people, and the several different funding agencies, USDA, Florida Fish and Wildlife, and FLEPSI. But we also have to gratefully acknowledge the alligators at Payne's Prairie Preserve State Park for keeping their distance from us most of the time. And that's it. Nice, short, and sweet. Yeah. That's all it takes. I'll take any questions. Yeah.
So I've read a lot about Ruellia, and I'm trying to, I've seen in the literature about this vegetative threat, but I haven't really seen it in action except for my neighbors really coming up in my yard, just a couple pieces. So what's your assessment of really the threat of vegetative spread with this species?
Very, very high, and it's very interesting that you asked that, because I was wondering that too. And my technician and I, last month when we were collecting data down here, I just wanted to do a quick and dirty thing, and I have 35 plots set up in Sanford in this floodplain where Ruellia is invading. And I wanted us to try pulling up five different plants in each plot and actually collect the data on it, just rough and dirty, get an idea of what we're looking at. And maybe 99% of it is vegetatively. There only 1% was actual seedling that we're pulling up. Everything is through rhizomes.
So, is anyone doing any research to look at how much does this plant spread vegetatively per year?
Yeah, not that I'm aware of, but I think that is something that needs to be looked at.
All right, let me play devil's advocate, though. We're only talking about a foot a year. It's not like it's a seed blown by the wind or a fruit eaten by a bird and carried thousands of feet or miles. You know, the risk from a vegetative spread seems much less than from a seed being dispersed by wind or by animals.
You could argue that, but I guess I'm a little bit biased because, and I'm sure Dia understands too, you know, going out in those natural areas and you walk out and it's just a blanket of this one plant. I mean, it's quite heartening. And then you see it planted in people's landscapes, and it's a featured plant in the gardens. But I still think it's something that we need to look at. And I know from experience, I've had land managers come up to me and say, you know, thank goodness you're looking at this, because even when we, you know, spray it with herbicide, it's, you know, there's encroachment, it's coming right back in, and it's just a constant struggle. So managers are looking at the financial costs of it. You know, labor, sending someone out to spray it, but they have, and you know, paying someone to do it, and it's just, it's a lot, and they need help, and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. So if you have data on it, say it only spreads. I know you're being devil's advocate.
Another factor, though, that counteracts what I just said, mm-hmm. is particularly in your waterways, you could have vegetative pieces float away, mm-hmm. so to speak, and spread that way.
Yeah.
So there are conditions each way.
Definitely, yeah. We just need to really, we're trying to get a handle on it, so we're doing what we can. At least we know how to control it. Now we just have to figure out how to manage it and restore the areas. Yes?
This might have been before you came along, but when you decided on an herbicide spray to remove, to clean up the site, was that based on the meta-analysis, or was that based on experiments with Borrelia?
That was based upon it was an experiment, it wasn't published. I guess you call it more of like a preliminary subjective study done by Randall Stocker. Was he, Sandy, University of Florida? He actually looked at different herbicides and tested them on Ruellia at my location many years ago. Unfortunately, he never actually published the data, but he did share with our lab what his findings were and everything. So based upon that, we selected the glyphosate because that was the most successful for him. But at the same time, I was at a meeting, a FLEPC meeting back in April, and I had one of the managers ask me, he's like, okay, well, you can spray glyphosate. Have you ever thought about, and that's a broad spectrum herbicide, have you ever thought about spraying triclopyr, which is a selective herbicide over top? I'm like, that's a great idea. You know, maybe the natives will come back that way. But we also have to consider the soils as well.
Well, and I was going to say, I think consider maybe like pulling that one out because it has a lot of underground biomass, I think you said earlier. And so maybe that is more effective than herbicide treatment. Is that what you consider?
Unfortunately, no, because I think it's so labor intensive. I mean, the rhizomes are just a mat. And the chances of someone just pulling one up and then breaking the rhizome, it'll trigger another shoot to come up. Yeah. Yeah.
When you apply the glyphosate, does it kill the rhizomes that are underneath, or it doesn't?
From what we're seeing, no. I mean, it has very low, minimal soil activity, so it may affect it a little bit. I'm not 100% on that, but what I am seeing in my plots is that I am seeing shoots coming up from already established rhizomes. So I think we're able to knock it back enough, which is why I want to be able to restore, add native seed or seedlings to the area and trying to let those natives get a hold on to the bare ground before the Ruellia comes back, and maybe it can outcompete the Ruellia altogether. But to answer your question, I think the new shoots are actually coming from already established rhizomes. Both, yeah, shaded and sunny, at least in my location, yeah.
Yeah, the ones that are in shady areas, the invasion must have occurred initially by seed.
Mm-hmm.
And then the plants that are there wouldn't flower very much because it's shaded. And so then the secondary invasion is by the rhizome.
Yep, and that's exactly what I'm seeing. Yep.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I want to say it was a 2% solution.
And you never did test the truck pool?
No. I honestly never thought about it until a manager said that to me a couple months ago. I'm like, that would be actually pretty interesting because that would be more efficient for them as opposed to revegetating if they don't have to. You had a question?
So it sounds like a lot of them sort of thick establishments in the ride zones, right? So how useful is having a sterile cultivar? I mean, that's not really going to reduce its invasiveness that much. And I know that this isn't really part of your project.
No, that's fine. No, I think it's wonderful to have sterile cultivars because in a perfect world, I mean, you guys can chime in. We would love to be able to tell growers, you know, please do not grow this invasive Ruellia and, you know, take it from them. But we can't just take that plant from them and not give them something in return. So if we could get a hold of the cultivars and be able to eventually maybe, you know, take out the production of the invasive Ruellia and give them a completely fine, not, you know, sterile, non-invasive cultivar. That would be ideal for them because it helps, and it's with that the economy too. I mean, $12 million in 2004 for this one plant with the invasive. I think it would really help the economy too. Yeah. Do you guys have any to chime in on that?
Well, the invasion occurred through seed dispersal of the fertile types,
yes,
into the natural areas. Mm-hmm. So that's already done. But if we can prevent, say, having more of these fertile types being planted in our gardens and planting the sterile ones instead, then there'll be less invasions.
Yeah, less new invasions. So we just have to manage the older invasions. Yeah, that would be ideal.
Evaluate these sterile cultivars for vegetative spread.
Because definitely.
Then you get into the thing where if you do have rhizome chunks that can be vegetatively propagate the plant, then you might spread it through garden refuse or, you mm-hmm. know, other, if it's along a waterway or whatever.
Yeah.
I still think it's a much greater risk than windblown or seed dispersal animals and through.
Well, I do think it definitely starts through the stormwater runoff because that's where we're seeing it. You know, it's planted all over Gainesville, it's planted all over Orlando, all even along, you know, our coastal communities as well. And then we see it in those floodplain communities adjacent to urban areas.
So you think the seeds go into the runoff?
The stormwater runoff into the wetlands, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, there's been data on it that I think it was, 20 meters? Maybe it was more from 95? Three? Really? I thought it was more. Thank you.
And they can germinate inside water.
Yeah, yep. I see that in my greenhouse. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Well, this concludes the formal invasive plants workshop for today. We are going to have an invasive plants working group following this, so I would encourage you to stick around and stay for that. Again, I really want to thank our three speakers from coming in who would not normally have been here at ASHS, but we kind of recruited them to come teach us a little about this. So let's give them another round of applause. Thank you.